I'm Rachel Olson. I'm a recent graduate from the University of Virginia with a degree in religious studies. And this is the Digital Project on Virginia and Civil Rights on the project of Lived Theology.
And I'm Josh Shimanaka. I am also a recent graduate from the University of Virginia, studied biochemistry and religious studies, and I'm also an intern on the project of Lived Theology studying civil rights.
Thank you for being with us here today. For those of you listening, this is Dr. Douglas E. Thompson. He's a graduate of the University of Virginia. He has his PhD in religious studies, and he is now currently a professor at Mercer University, and he teaches history and Southern history in Georgia. He's also the director of the Spencer B. King Jr. Center for Southern Studies. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking me.
Yes. And so today we'll be talking about your book that you wrote. He's the author of Richmond's Priests and Prophets, Race, Religion, Social Change in the Civil Rights Era. So with that, are you okay with go ahead and jump into the questions?
Sure.
Okay, so our first question for you today is, can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write your book?
Sure. The longer story, which I won't give you all of, was that I originally started a project on lynching in Virginia and realized two things. One, I could not sit with that project for a long period of time, given what I was finding. And I knew I had to sit with a project for a long time. And also Don Matthews at Carolina was already working on a project similar to something I was thinking through. So I just gave him all the material I was finding. But in the process, noticed that I kept finding more source material in Richmond, not around lynching, but more around the issues of Jim Crow and segregation and desegregation. And so searching in one direction, I went in a different direction for my dissertation. That was the beginning of the subject that became the book. And so I became interested in part because most of what in the early 1990s that had been written about white churches regarding civil rights movement had been largely dismissive or sort of in the Sam Hill vein, which is that they didn't do anything. And I was finding, at least in Richmond, that there were churches that were actively, in particular pastors or ministers, who were actively working for desegregation. Both in schools, so that's where the book mostly focuses, is how the conversation around Brown versus Board of Education forced churches to have to think about desegregation, but also within their own congregations. And so I realized that at least in Richmond, I could tell a story that looked a little bit different than what we typically talk about. But also, I think, at least this was the hope, help explain why it's hard to actually talk about churches as a singular political entity or a political response, because they have lots of essentially nuance within how they are interpreting both the Bible and their own polity, which is what I hope to have covered in the book.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Thank you. Our next question for you. You write about the influence of five religion editors. What kind of influence would these editors have had? Like, who are these men and what views did they hold on integration?
Yeah, so they did this part of the book helps sort of set the remainder of the book, so that there's a conversation around, mostly around Brown versus Board of Education, although the chapter really begins with some work that was done in some of these books, these editors' work earlier. But it's four, essentially four white editors and then an African-American editor. And what I wanted to do was allow for them to set up how each of the denominations were having these conversations, but more importantly, the way and the influence questions actually limited. They would have been very influential within their denominations. They would not have been influential beyond their denominations necessarily, although, as you sort of learn in the book, the Methodists carry on a pretty extended exchange with James Kilpatrick, particularly around this issue of turning private schools into public, getting public money, tax money. The Methodist editor kind of draws a line. He doesn't later. Later, he says, let's go ahead and do this. But early on, he draws a line at using public money for private institutions. And that seems to catch Kilpatrick off guard. It catches most segregationists off guard. which was kind of odd if they had, Kilpatrick is the editor of the Richmond News Leader. And so these editors are interacting in ways sort of beyond their local or their sort of narrow groupings. And so that exchange, I think, is helpful for recognizing the theological struggle that congregations had to, or denominations had to deal with. But it also is state religious editors, but then it has Aubrey Brown, who is a regional editor, and hit the Presbyterian Outlook is a region-wide newspaper. And so it would have had a broader reading. So I grouped them in a way so that you could see this sort of narrow focus, but then it pulled itself back out across the region, but then also beyond just the religious editors. But that they sort of serve as the backdrop for the remainder of the book, particularly as the as religious folks have to keep thinking about their own support of segregation, white religious folks, at least.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And then moving on into the topic of Brown v. Board of Education, what can you tell us about the situation in Virginia at the time of Brown versus Board of Education?
Yeah, so as I said in the book, the weird part for at least some of what was going on in Richmond is that segregationists were quite aware that the court was leaning towards ruling for Brown or ruling against segregation. I don't think anybody kind of assumed the sweeping decision that Brown elicited, and they definitely were not they were hopeful for a split court. They wanted a 5-4 court, but what they really were hoping for was a 6-3 court. The 9-0, I think, changed a lot of things on the ground, at least initially. And so I tried to explore that a little bit. What's interesting is that within Presbyterian life and within Methodist life, and to a lesser extent in Baptist life, the 9-0 decision was sort of like, this is the law of the land. We need to follow it. So the immediate response was to desegregate the schools. And in fact, Oliver Hill, who had been elected to Richmond's city council in the late 1940s, had been a sort of a prime mover of a group of educators and parents in Richmond. And so they actually were working through a series of plans for desegregating Richmond's public schools. And it is only in light of the sort of infancy of massive resistance, which almost everybody attaches to the Eastman speech on the Senate floor. But even as he's giving that speech, white denominations throughout the South are arguing for desegregation because that's what the law of the land is. I think segregationists found the loophole, which was that the court said, we realize how sweeping this is, so we're going to come back and argue implementation orders. And that gave everybody, but more importantly, segregationists, the year to figure out how to divert or at least undermine the Brown decision. And Brown, too, did not help. Right. So when the implementation order is essentially all deliberate speed, but no federal oversight, you're going to get exactly what you got, which is Richmond doesn't have a federal desegregation order until the late 1960s. And even then, it's the busing order. It's not desegregation. Kind of the way that you could think about this is the quietness that Candler Middle School desegregated in 1960. Right. So that neighborhood that I mentioned in the introduction about Barton Heights transitioned in the 1950s into the early 1960s. And so there was a lot of activity in Richmond to try and figure out how to desegregate, except that the state then impinged upon the desegregation orders movement. And so then you get this larger movement towards massive resistance. Although, as I say in the book, about the moment that Kilpatrick says massive resistance is dead, you get the Prince Edward County decision to shut down their school for 5 years, which I think is actually a more interesting story, but we still don't have that book written, right? That the the way that they navigated through it. But at least in Richmond, there was an argument for desegregation. And actually, it's religious folks who are doing it. So there are Catholic women who are actively working for desegregating schools. They're part of these committees with Oliver Hill. And so there's an impulse for desegregation, but the power, the political power of the Byrd machine and massive resistance sort of steps in. And this is my sense from the research, churches were kind of happy for that because what that meant was that they didn't really have to think more about what it meant to desegregate their own institutions, although they are having those conversations, but we probably will get to that later.
Thank you very much. Kind of as a follow-up question, some key features from your book believe that the Brown decision was too much of a sudden shift. Do you agree with this opinion given the subsequent reaction you talked about? Or was the Brown decision a necessary piece of legislation timed correctly?
Yeah, I'm going to answer in a personal response and then a scholarly response. The personal response is that I think it was necessary and I think it was timely. It does a bunch of different things, clearly not historical, but it's why I use the Flannery O'Connor short story, Revelation, as a way to think about it. Until Mrs. Turpin is hit in the face, she doesn't have to confront any of her, by the book, in the story, she doesn't have to confront any of her assumptions. And so the Brown decision actually forces white religious people to have to think about what it meant to desegregate not just the schools, but their own institutions, both the local congregations, but also their institutional structures. So Methodists have the central jurisdiction, which is where all African-American Methodists, so if jurisdictions are supposed to be geographical spaces. The central jurisdiction is the entirety of the United States. It just happens that they're African-Americans. Except that you would have African-American Methodist in the Virginia Conference. Well, the Virginia Conference has buildings and facilities that Black Methodists would have access to. And so again, Brown is the thing that causes them to have to think through, okay, what does it mean if we're gonna desegregate the schools? How do we desegregate the institutions? So I think it's timely in that way. It helps them sort of move forward. The scholarly part of me, its sweepingness also creates the reactionary response, right? So massive resistance becomes the political response to circumvent Brown versus Board of Education. And I don't give credence to the idea that they stepped outside of their jurisprudence in the decision, but they do maneuver around, the court maneuvers around legal precedent to make the argument, right? So there, that's my personal response, is I think that's what they should have done. And it's not inappropriate. It's exactly what the Dred Scott decision had done. It's exactly what the Plessy decision had done. So it's not unusual. It just turns out that the reactionary forces of massive resistance, they hung their hat on that piece. And it gave an intellectual credibility to circumventing Brown that I think it would not have had if the court had spent more time dealing with the jurisprudence piece of the equation. But again, like I said, I think I can answer that in sort of two different ways. I think it's necessary because it's only when you get confronted do you have to think about something. I'm not sure what the confrontation moment is because often, I thought Ferguson was the moment, right? That and Black Lives Matter, that it would be the thing that hit you in the face and you would go, oh, okay, we're going to start making changes. That's not it. Tamar Rice, right? Aubrey, right? Like and all of a sudden it's George Floyd, right? What is the one? And even then it's not full, and it has reactionary responses. And so that's the part that I think is interesting to understand. And at least for a historian, it was a way to think about how the sources were thinking about this political entity, Brown, right? This sort of non-church thing. And then they talked and thought in terms of their own congregations and their own institutions. And it had a theological conversation to it.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
More broadly, who do you believe were the most outspoken integrationist during this era?
Yeah. So the person I think who plays the biggest role is the opening person in chapter one. It's John Marion. He's a Presbyterian preacher who does something bizarre in the 1940s and sort of doesn't beat a war drum at a moment where you sort of expect him to. He also loses his church, so that was a pretty good indication that you can only push so far or so hard. He takes on a variety of roles in Richmond. I think he makes family choices. And so he is one of the more outspoken advocates for, and I'm going to use I'm going to do something I try to do in the book. Oliver Hill taught me this. I think John Marion was an integrationist. And I think that in a cultural sense, right? Like, we need to learn from African Americans, and we need to embrace their understanding of society. I don't think everyone who was for desegregating schools was an integrationist. So Oliver Hill used to draw this distinction. He would say we weren't for integration; we were for desegregation. We wanted access to things that we were contributing to, right? And his example of this was public tax money puts together public schools. If a child lives near what we typically refer to as a white school, and you base all of your decisions about proximity, neighborhood schools, right? They should go to that school. Their parents are paying taxes the same way everyone else. That's an access question. It doesn't have to be just about taxes. So this was actually pretty important in the Birmingham protest. If you take our money for buying dresses right around the Easter time, we should be allowed to try the dresses on, know that they fit, and if they don't, give them back. That's an access question, right? Oliver Hill was very careful to point out he didn't have anything to do with white people in the neighborhood he moved into, right? That he said that was integration. I didn't want anything from them. And so he talked a lot about desegregation versus integration. And I try to make that point in the book that the word integration, at least understood by white Richmonders, was about race mixing, right? That's their language, race mixing. And in fact, Oliver Hill talked about it that way, right? It would be pushing cultural or social norms together and integrating them in all kinds of ways. And most of the folks who were advocating for this kind of work, except John Marion, and probably Aubrey Brown is a good example, the editor of the Presbyterian Outlook, are desegregationists. They'll use the word integration, and they probably mean it at some level, but the racial component of integration was problematic. Sort of the notion of white supremacy, which I try to talk a little bit about, that's built into even the desegregation argument at some level. And so I think John Marion and Aubrey Brown are really good examples of integrationists. So they're advocating for integrating the churches, or at least the institutions. Aubrey Brown goes to a Black congregation, so he's an example of that. So in Barton Heights, there was I left it out of the book, but in the dissertation, There are five white congregations in Barton Heights, which is just north of downtown Richmond. In 1950 and 1960, there's only one, but they've all been replaced by denominationally affiliated churches. So Barton Heights Baptist Church sells its facility to First African Baptist. They move into Barton Heights because their membership has been moving into that part of Richmond. The only one that stays is Barton Heights Methodist Church, and they will stay until the 1980s, and then they move out farther out Chamberlain Avenue. And so the Presbyterian congregation that comes into Barton Heights, Aubrey Brown is an active member of that congregation. So I think he thought in terms of integration. I know his son did. Because I interviewed him, but for most folks, it was about desegregating, which is we're going to keep separate spaces, but the access argument worked. We understood it as access, and so I try to delineate that a little bit in the book. So I did in the answer too.
Thank you very much. And yeah, mm-hmm. The distinction between integration versus desegregation, very clear. Thank you.
Yeah, and real quick. One of the places that showed up and became real to me, so it wasn't just Oliver Hill, but the place where that became real to me is, and I do this in the book, the Catholic Church takes a lot of pride in talking about desegregating the Friday before the Brown decision on Monday. But Ireton shut down St. Joseph's Catholic school. And they argued that school should be shut down because its size, it was shrinking. It wasn't. In fact, the Virginia Catholic newspaper shows a steady increase in their membership. And there has been a long-term fallout of shutting down that school and in the name of desegregating parishes, shutting down that church. And so African-Americans often would say, what you mean by integration is that I have to become white, right? Like we have to sort of disappear and become like you. And that church, that's exactly what happened within Catholic life. That had long-range consequences. It is an important distinction for me.
Thank you very much. Next question. How impactful do you think the RBank, the NAACP, the VCC, the VCHR, and the SCR were in this setting?
Yeah, I think all of those organizations, it became interesting. At one point, I wanted to follow them all out, and it turns out they didn't do really well with their church members, their membership list. And so what I really wanted to do was sort of create could I pull together how they were networked? What they did really well was they kept subject matter in front of people, often through mailers. Which was the big deal, but they were also preaching to the choir. Sorry, I don't mean the pause, right? But I'm going to use church language. They were preaching to the choir. So people who joined them were often already sort of on board with a lot of what they believed were positive possibilities. They often were on board as much. I mean, this is kind of the history I'm ready to have written. Like the Chamber of Commerce, they play a huge role in ending the sit-in movement in Richmond. I didn't do much with them, but they play a significant role because it's clear to them that it's hurting business, right? So there's a business piece. And most of the folks in these organizations recognize that and were happy to kind of push. But I think your question's at the sort of bigger issue, which is, how much influence did they have in Richmond, right? The broader community. And what I tried to point out in the book was that we often highlight their work as examples of progressive Southerners. It spread until later in the 1960s. And so I don't know that their influence was nearly as big as we typically talk about or write about. But their ability to keep the subject matter in front of people, I think what did matter, right? Eventually, it became clear, I think, to moderate segregationists. I know that sounds like a weird phrase, but people who were willing to participate in segregation because it benefited them, but they weren't willing to hurt people or they weren't going to stay with it necessarily. I think they could be affected by it, that kind of language, but it was going to take a really long time. You weren't going to get change overnight. And in fact, most of those organizations sort of start dissolving by the mid-1960s and morphing into other things. And again, and another project that would be a great book to write is the way that civil rights organizations reformatted themselves from 1965 forward. So what happens when the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and then particularly the Civil Rights Act of 1968, all come into existence? And there seems to be this assumption about, well, we're okay, we move on to other things, and we weren't okay, right? Like that. So there's a morphing thing that's going on as well. And so I want them to have widespread, this is personal, I want them to have widespread influence. I don't think they do. And y'all are probably going to ask this question, or at least it's the thing that people are most fascinated by in the book, is that when the Presbyterians desegregate their summer camp in the summer of 1957, this is not the courts, this is not Brown versus Board of Education, but everything that segregationists were fighting against was happening in that camp. Black boys and white boys were sleeping together and eating together. Black girls and white girls were sleeping together and eating together. All of them were eating together, right? The full form of what that desegregation promise was going to be. And I know personally that there were people who showed up and saw that it was desegregated that week, put their children back in the car and drove them home, right? So you can have a change, whether or not it's widespread, which is an influence question, is not clear. I'm not sure I answered you directly because my brain's working towards this idea of what influence means, which is actually a project the book was trying to figure out. Did people actually make changes? I think individuals changed. I don't know that whole systems changed.
And back to, thanks for bringing up the concept of Camp Hanover. How do you believe that Camp Hanover contributed to the overall consensus of race at the time?
Yeah, so that is a fascinating story all by itself. It clearly couldn't be a book by itself. As I write in the book, First Presbyterian does not have a pastor during this. They do when the camp announces that it's going to have a desegregated summer camp. That pastor disappears, and so they're with an interim. And so the presbytery has a little more control. Lay members of the presbytery have a little more control in that particular congregation. During that time period, this is in the weeds kind of moment, but in Presbyterian life, overtures are the way that you handle, in the session, the lay leaders would have had more control. In the presbytery, overtures are ways that you handle business. So you think something needs to be changed, you present an overture, the body addresses it in the presbytery. It's in the presbytery meets in the fall after that summer of 1957. The session from First Presbyterian overtures and says, we didn't agree to this. No one voted on it. When I came across that overture in the minutes, in the presbytery minutes, I was struck. I didn't remember seeing a vote on desegregating summer, the summer camp. And in fact, the response inside of the minutes for that particular presbytery said, oh no, we had an open vote and the presbytery agreed to this. I went back through, there was no open vote. The only reference is the naming of, or the vote for and the naming of the executive director of the camp, a guy named Ensign. And it gave him full authority over the camp. So it may be that the desegregationists were assuming that that was the vote, or someone hoped there was a vote, or, and this is the fun of primary source material for historians, there was no vote. It was actually the auspices of sort of one person. And Ensign had been a pretty big advocate for things like desegregation and other kind of progressive tendencies within the church his entire life. And so that wouldn't have been odd. There was an announcement that only a few of the weeks would be desegregated. So they were trying hard to, I think, create space on either side so that if you were a family member and you didn't want desegregated opportunities. But remember, I told you there's a Black Presbyterian church in Barton Heights. That's their summer camp, right? So the institution, the summer camp institution, is trying to figure out how to have their own membership participate. And so that's why that conversation about desegregating Camp Hanover, I think, is interesting. Because what it did was it showed that the East, well, at that point, it's the East Hanover Presbytery, but it's called the Hanover Presbytery for most of its history. The Hanover Presbytery is on the front edge of desegregation, right? They want a desegregated space, both in their institution, but also within their congregations. But not everybody in the presbytery did. And First Presbyterian and Second Presbyterian are examples of people who don't want their children desegregated in a camp setting. And so actually, I think the camp highlights not so much a consensus as much as it showed how a denominational entity could push forward and have a push back against it almost at the exact same moment. So that they are, it's why you don't get singular voices, right? You can't say, but you don't get a clear consensus on LGBTQ plus issues today, right? Like in my head, that is exactly what I was learning from the 1950s is, we kind of keep hoping that there's this prophetic voice and that's what the church is. And the church is always that, and it's not. It is this complicated social creature made up of complicated creatures, us. And it does all kinds of interesting and convoluted and often confusing things. And so actually, I don't think Camp Hanover created consensus. I think it showed how I don't like the word because it's not across the board, but a progressive tendency on race in the East Hanover Presbytery was met with an equal force among the laity about, nope, this is not what we're doing. I think the interesting part of that is that the Presbytery voted at least twice, and I think they voted a third time, about reverting back to segregated summer camps. And the Presbytery voted every time to leave it desegregated. And so at least at a polity level, so the way the structure of the presbytery, which is dominated by ministers, they continue to hold a power over desegregating the camp. But I made it more veiled because if this is going to be a public interview, I have family members, but there's a footnote in the Camp Hanover story about my aunt, my grandfather, who took his daughters to the camp and put them back in the car and took them home, right? So that power of individuals as well as collectives to withdraw their support or their money is an example of this kind of tension that I think I hope that that story helped elevate in the way that the other example is in that chapter is the Methodist bishop who might be the most ardent segregationist I have ever encountered. And I've encountered a lot, but one of the most ardent segregationists I've ever encountered, who let his pastors continue to sort of argue for desegregation in a way that, at least in the structure of their church, he didn't have to. He could have told them no, he could have punished them, and he didn't. At least, well, he did one, and the church, the laity at the church, made him go back on his decision. And so it creates all kinds of interesting ways to see, I think, American congregational life and polity, to think about the way these issues influence or interact with people. So, but yeah, I don't know that there's a straight consensus that comes out of Camp Hanover. I think it helped draw the lines. And oddly enough, probably not where y'all intended to go with this. I think we see the lines today in the book. Like, I think the way in which the lines are starting to develop as we think about these things are going in place in this time period. So I'll concede on school desegregation, but I'm not going to concede on notions of white supremacy, right? Like, I don't get any benefit. So I don't know why you keep talking about this kind of language or reparations, right? That is sort of a non-starter, or was a non-starter for a long time. I think those lines are drawn fairly early in this process, or at least I tried to point out, again, not that it's, you're not reading today in the book, but I think those lines are in place or developing as we move forward.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Very interesting. Turning back to massive resistance, how did the Byrd administration contribute to efforts of segregation? Do you believe that this was a mishandling of power?
Ooh, the last part of that one is a little subjective for a historian, but not a religious studies scholar, right? I get to work in both worlds, which usually confuses folks. Just in case you know, interdisciplinary degrees are very strange to people. Okay, so how do they contribute? Or how does the Byrd machine contribute? They're fascinating in a lot of ways, most notably because their headquarters is based up in Winchester, right? So Byrd is from the northern part of the Shenandoah Valley, but their political base is in Virginia Southside. So I tried to delineate this. So if you follow the James River, anything south of the James River all the way through to the Blue Ridge Mountains, and then if you just sort of imaginatively carry that across into the Appalachians, those regions were loyal to the Byrd machine. He was guaranteed to always get votes out of Southside Virginia. The reason why that matters is that it's Prince Edward County is in Southside Virginia, right? So the segregationist, the most extreme form of fighting Brown is Prince Edward County, right? So massive resistance had argued, we will do everything in our power not to desegregate. We will close down schools to keep from desegregating. Prince Edward County is the only one that does it. A few try, but kind of immediately sort of like, this is crazy. They pull it off for 5 years. So that political base is really strong in the South. It's actually pretty strong in Central Virginia as well, around the Richmond area. Although the Byrd machine gets challengers who come from that that area. And so it is a carefully crafted machine. So from starting in the mid 20s through really 1966, between 66 and 68, there are no unpredictable elections in Virginia. They just, or if they are, they're going to be in places like Northern Virginia or perhaps out down in the Tidewater area. But by and large, you're not going to have an unpredictable election. And you're, anyone who tried to challenge the Byrd machine almost always was defeated. A good example of this is a successful defeat of the Byrd machine in Charlottesville. But that was a hyper-localized election. And that's kind of the only way you could undermine the machine as a total in its whole. More to your question, Lindsey Allman, who is governor at the time that Brown is announced, it had been attorney general prior to that, had been sort of a moderate on race questions prior to this period. And while governor, he moves to Byrd, right? He moves to the massive resistance position very harshly and in a sort of, wrong word for today, but totalitarian kind of way, right? So the weird part about the massive resistance laws that get put in place in 1956 is that they allow the governor to have final say on pupil placement. Like literally one person could have a decision about where a student went. And it was largely designed to sort of circumvent wholesale desegregation. Kilpatrick makes this argument fairly early in 1956. If somebody in Pulaski County wants to desegregate, go ahead. You're talking about probably 10 African-American families total. I'm making that number up. But like he said, the number is so small. If they want to desegregate, that's not a problem. Virginia South Side, that's a problem. It's the top of the Black Belt. So the Black Belt that runs across the South ends at the James River or in that space, near that space around Richmond. And so in every county around Prince Edward County, African-Americans outnumber whites by almost 3-1. So desegregation in those spaces meant wholesale change to the school district. And that seemed intolerable to those folks. And so the Byrd machine often played on that South Side fear, like this idea that everything that we know is going to be uprooted and changed. And so their political calculations were right. They played them correctly. And in fact, that power structure stays in place in Southside Virginia, even as the Byrd machine starts to lose elections, sort of broader state elections. The Southside does not bend very much. Even up into the 1980s. And then you're at that point, we're talking about a different kind of shift. We're talking about that larger shift from national political parties, from Democrats to Republicans. And the Byrd machine would not have been part of that. Like that would be anathema to them. So
thank you.
You bet.
Could you tell us about the Gray Commission? And do you think that the Gray plan would have been a better rebuttal to desegregation?
Okay. So the Gray Commission is set up largely to maintain white control. So that's the reason for its existence. But it's also trying to navigate and it does it in two ways. One is it's actually using sort of state resources. So the General Assembly representatives, but also Board of Education people, right? And it's trying to navigate, okay, we have a court order. this is the law. We have to figure out how to follow the law. What's the best way that we can follow law without having to give over completely to fully desegregated spaces, right? The school spaces. And so the Gray Commission really did look like a negotiated settlement, right? So they often, the Gray Commission was very open to this idea of desegregating spaces where it made sense to desegregate them, often with the notion that white power was not going to be touched. But they even made some concessions in and around metropolitan areas, particularly around Richmond, giving school boards a little more authority than segregationists would have ever been comfortable with. The fascinating part about the Gray Commission is that it looks like it has all of the support until the massive resistance argument kicks in, right? And that's what I meant by that Brown 2 decision. It gave enough space for massive resistance or ardent segregationists to figure out how to respond. The weird thing for me was that Kilpatrick was in communication. He does these series of annulment, nullification idea, the Virginia-Kentucky resolution stuff. He does a series of these editorial positions. I had somebody ask me one time, he said, those are unsigned editorials. How do you know they're Kilpatrick's? He ran the news leader fairly centrally. I am confident that if he had final sign off, whether or not he's writing the words, I'm convinced he wrote those two, those nullification editorials in particular. That had actually been it's an antiquated argument. It's a Calhoun argument from the 1830s and 40s. Like it doesn't make any sense. But what he was trying to do was circumvent the citizen councils, particularly in Mississippi, because they actually were figuring out how to circumvent Brown on a segregationist academy system, right? Take public money, use it for private education. And he seemed to recognize that there was sort of an intellectual argument that was at stake, a constitutional argument. The reason that's fascinating to me is that's actually the William F. Buckley trajectory. And so you see in the 1950s, a version of intellectual conservatism that is going to come forward, that we're going to argue this on principles, right? That kind of thing. What's interesting is that when the Gray Commission stuff starts coming forward to be voted on, so it's going to be an electoral process. Kilpatrick jumps ship and immediately starts calling for full-scale closures. So here's a guy who had been arguing for an intellectual argument, a constitutional kind of argument, abandons it. And that worked with the Byrd machine piece so well that the moderate voices within Virginia were overwhelmed, and the Gray Commission just largely disappears. Like it loses out, and it is abandoned. And in fact, the idea that you're going to get a statewide desegregation is largely gone. Only the federal courts are going to get that form of desegregation. Localities might continue to pull it off, partly because they stopped worrying about what a state entity would do to them. But this was placing all of the authority in like the governor's hands. That was the intent to undermine the Gray Commission. So yes, right. This that weird thing that we do. The Gray Commission is the moderate voice. But it's a moderate voice for white supremacy, for white power. It wasn't going to change a whole lot on the ground as far as African-American participation. That's why that desegregation integration language was really important. So you weren't going to get Black school board members. If you desegregated a district, the Black school teachers were going to lose their jobs. You weren't going to have Black administrators. within school districts. Desegregation essentially was going to be integration into a white school system. And the Gray Commission, that's what they wanted, right? That was how they were going to navigate that Brown decision. It got pulled out from underneath of them. And this hardline segregationist position, the massive resistance position, is what won out. And so the Gray Commission turns out looking moderate. It's within, at least I hope I pointed out in the book, within certain sectors of American religious life, it's not even, Gray Commission's not moderate. It's still a very conservative take on desegregation. But if massive resistance is the thing on the spectrum next to it, it looked like a more palatable kind of response. It literally was abandoned almost overnight. It is stunning to watch how quickly that thing seems to be what's moving forward, and then all of a sudden it's gone. So
fascinating. Thank you.
Yep.
What do you think massive resistance meant for the religious community in Richmond at the time?
So, because in the book, I try to explain that there's not a singular white religious community. Massive resistance meant different things to different people. Aubrey Brown and people at Union Theological Seminary in Richmond, not everyone, as I point out in the book, but enough people at Union, John Marion, those folks are all sort of flabbergasted that massive resistance is winning. Oliver Hill was not surprised by massive resistance. I think if you're an African-American in Richmond or in Virginia at the time, you know this is coming, or a version of this is coming. There's a religious community that it is completely frustrated by mass resistance. I think the Marion, Aubrey Brown, a part of the spectrum, are also equally frustrated by mass resistance and its power and ability. I think if you're a member at First Presbyterian at the time, or any of them that are advocating for not desegregation so fast, massive resistance was a shield, right? It protected them. They didn't have to think about it anymore. They didn't have to figure out what to do if their neighborhood school desegregated. What it really did was it gave those folks time to move farther west and north in Henrico County. And so the phrase white flight that we get, massive resistance provided cover for the ability to move out into the counties. And I think you see a large scale abandonment of the city during it starts in the early period of massive resistance, but really takes off early 1970s with the busing decision, right? Like that now you've got to go way out. You can't stay sort of in town or near town. And so I think it provided cover for some. And as there's some really good work that's been done since the book came out for how white Christians are openly advocating for this form of segregation, right? And so massive resistance was not only the right political move, it's the right theological move, right? So what I want you to, I hope a reader could see that if you want to talk about a political spectrum that spans a spectrum, that's the theological response as well to massive resistance. That there is a broad recognition that this was changing their lives, whatever that meant. For some, it would be positive, like this is a good thing. For others, it would be it changes the world that I know, and I don't want that world to change, right? And so massive resistance, I think, becomes a way to think about how people respond from their religious sensibilities into the political world. The thing that I probably would write now, if I could write the book again or write a second edition to it, is that I think I would have been bolder to say the religious position is a political position. That theology is political, regardless of whether it's what we typically refer to as progressive or conservative, right? It's always political because it's always as part of a public sphere, right? And I don't mean that as the church's public property, but it's in a public space. It's in an open space. And so people who are making the choice to leave downtown Richmond or leaving parts of Henrico County to go to Hanover County, right? This is the later 1980s flight. They often did that because that's where their churches do that because that's where their churches went. Their church members moved out, right? They went out. Well, that's a political statement. I don't want people not like me in my neighborhood. And so the churches are making political statements all along the spectrum. And so massive resistance became a way to think about that process.
Thank you. And speaking of the different views of the religious communities, specifically, Richmond has two Black Presbyterian congregations. Did this affect their view of these issues?
Yeah. So Barton Heights, the Presbyterian congregation that was started in Church Hill kind of comes and goes during this period. It's very active. It appears in the 1930s and early into the 1940s. And then for some reason in the presbytery, it disappears. But Barton Heights Presbyterian picks up. Sorry, a book's written long enough ago that I forget the name. It might not be Barton Heights Presbyterian. All Souls. Sorry, I knew I'd get it. All Souls Presbyterian. So their response to massive resistance or any of these kinds of issues was to keep being themselves, right? They kept worshiping. They kept interacting with the communities that were around them. They are the first congregation. They're mixed at one point. So they're the first congregation that has a Black pastor of a mixed congregation. So they become sort of this example of what it means to have an integrated space. It is some of their folks who are going to be people who apply for desegregating Candler Middle School Chandler Middle School in the Barton Heights area. And so they are active people, but I don't pick them up anywhere else other than in Presbyterian life. So I don't see, again, there are moments where I jump outside of it. Oliver Hill becomes a very important resource for me, in part because he's one of the two that argue the Prince Edward County case that becomes the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And he was fascinated in all kinds of ways. I met him at his daughter's house to interview him. And he said, I don't know why you're talking to me. Black preachers they made my life miserable. That wasn't the word he used. He said they thwarted every opportunity we tried to have a successful civil rights movement. So I don't know why I can't talk about religious stuff. That's okay. That's sort of what I want to talk about. And so often, like All Souls Presbyterian, their minister is very active in the community, but he's active within these ministerial associations. And in fact, he is very active in that, leads them at one point, an interracial ministerial association. But I don't follow out membership. And in fact, if there's a flaw in the book and someone could write this later, you would, if you could find the membership rosters or roles and actually see how members were doing, would be interesting. But All Souls didn't, like, leaders popped up, not individuals within the congregation. But they are, at least for the 1950s and 60s, they are, if you believe in the beloved community as lived out on earth, they are it, right? They embody that spirit. But they're rare, not normative, in that space.
Thank you. You also argue that anti-Catholic sentiment actually worked to prevent segregationists from simply moving to states supporting private education. Can you please explain how anti-Catholic sentiment was tied to these debates?
Yeah, so the Baptist newspaper does this a lot, and this is kind of a fairly typical Baptist trope in American history, in a religious liberty kind of argument. But what it means is that you're going to use public funds for parochial education. So that's the thread. It's actually the Methodist paper that makes this argument more repeatedly, at least early on. Again, they abandon it later. But they make this argument repeatedly early on, that using public money for private education, I'm using the language that the anti-Catholics would use, using public money for private education would mean Catholic schools or Catholic parents could use that money for Catholic education. Part of why I included that was at least at some level helped me, whether or not this works for everyone else, but it helped me think about the way in which Protestants had been thinking about public education as a normative Protestant project. And private education was something that Catholics had to do. And so what you wanted to do was always keep public money out of private schools. And that's where that language of parochial comes from. So what you didn't want was tax money being diverted to Catholic schools. At least the Protestant mouthpieces, newspaper editors in particular, they were the first to start pointing out that if you allowed for the use of public money for private schools, which was the quickest way to deal with Brown, right? Just send everybody to a private school. Private schools can do anything that they want. As long as you don't take public money, you can have an all-white student body. What was interesting to me was the way in which, at least as I was reading secondary sources, we don't spend a lot of time thinking about how Protestants dominated public education, and that Brown, or at least massive resistance solution to Brown, highlighted that anti-Catholic sentiment, right? So it brought it forward in a way that they were unabashedly willing to talk about. And the reason that became fascinating to me is that the Catholic Virginian almost immediately started saying, please don't vote for the use of public money for private schools. Their editor, Daly, their editor, and the bishop as well, immediately started pushing because Catholic families were like, yes, we get to use public monies for. And so any vote that would have gone before the public would have had support of Catholic voters. And in the newspaper, the Catholic Virginian, Daly is like right on almost out the gate saying, no, this is terrible, because it's actually going to create anti-Catholic sentiment. Catholic women's organizations are arguing against it almost from the beginning as well. So there's a lot of sort of recognition that this anti-Catholic sentiment is actually attached to the notion of public education as Protestant dominated or Protestant normative. I don't pull this out in the book, but that's a good, it's a good example of almost everybody goes to prayer in public schools, the court decision about prayer in public. It's actually Bible reading. That's the more interesting one, because the argument had been made by Catholics that they keep reading from the King James Bible in these school districts. The King James Bible is a decidedly anti-Catholic translation of scripture. And so that idea won in the court was not so much that that you shouldn't have scripture reading. It was that one voice got privileged among others. Again, I don't pull that out in the book, but that sentiment is clearly starting to make its way out into the conversation. And so, again, that's where that public school, Protestant control over public education, particularly in the South, was so strong massive resistance solution to just use public money for private value. Again, feel free to edit this out. It's the school voucher conversation. Long before we're having a school voucher conversation. The interesting part for me is the voices that were arguing against this idea of a school voucher for massive resistance in the late 1950s and 1960s are ardently arguing for school voucher systems today, right? So that's one of those political shifts that I think are underway. But at least at this point, it was more important to hold the line on Catholicism than it was private education or segregation.
Thank you so much. And our last question for you today is, what would you ultimately like people to know about this period in Virginia's history?
Oh, the short answer is it's complicated. that's the historian in me. The one of the readers for the Alabama, University of Alabama Press said, the book is really good about Richmond. It's got to stop making larger arguments about the South, right? And so where those happened, I kind of pulled them out. Part of that is, I think, at least in the two places that the reader pointed it out, it was an appropriate response. I would like for people to recognize that the story that I tell in Richmond in the 1950s actually has a lot of currency for things that we have been dealing with since the 1950s. This question about how much influence do religious people have, right? Well, it depends on who you are. If you're Catholic, you have, generally speaking, not had a lot of power. That's changed in the last 10 to 15 years, but it didn't prior to that. But if you're Protestant and white, you have a lot of power, right? The responses to what it might mean to diminish that power were across the spectrum, right? So there are people who engage it and say, yes, we have things to learn. We will be better off. We will be a more coherent society. This is the John Marion response. We would be a more coherent society if we practice biblical concepts. Love thy neighbor, right? And neighbor means everyone. So that's one kind of response. But I think within religious studies life, and Charles Marsh and I have had this conversation, right? I think we want to privilege that prophetic voice we think that's what the church is, except that if you're following scripture, prophetic voices sort of come and go. They're not permanent. And so it's a good example that what I mean by complicated, that there are people who are going to see their faith as undergirding or grounding their political sensibility, the way they think they should raise their children, the conversations they should have around sexuality, right? They want total control over that. And it is their religious sensibility that is undergirding it. And sort of prophetic calls for desegregation weren't ever going to move them. And that complicated nature of how people live out their lives, their religious convictions, but they do them in public or political spaces, I think has a lot to tell us in Richmond in particular, but Virginia in the 1950s, about what has happened since that time period. Right, as rights language becomes more important, you see people sort of push back, not those rights, right? Not those individuals. That's not what the founders meant. So again, that sort of intellectual argument for what the Constitution stands for, that all of that is in the space that's going on inside of Richmond and Virginia a little bit larger during the 1950s. And I also think that if we spent more time looking at that decade as opposed to the 1960s, we might actually see some of how those responses in the 60s are baked in, right? Like you're going to get fairly conservative responses or assumptions that the world is changing too fast kind of language. That I think you can see in Virginia in the 1950s. So,
well, thank you so much for speaking to us today, and thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely, thank you for reading the book and engaging with it. I think, as I said in the email exchange with Isaac, like the book appeared and then largely just disappeared. I think one of the problems is that because it has Richmond in the title, there's an assumption that it's only about Richmond. And as your questions point out, I think it tells us a much bigger story, and it allows us to think about sort of larger context. So I appreciate that you read it and that you were willing to ask me questions about it. So thank you very much.
Have a very nice day.
Thanks. You all too.